For those of you who have just come in, we again apologize for the delay in starting this session, but we had a problem with the microphone in the last plenary session, and they were delayed in getting out. And we'll probably continue to have people come in. So once again, if you're sitting on the aisle, if you'll move in, I think we'll probably need every seat that we have here this afternoon. The name of this session is Book of Mormon Archaeology, What Does the Evidence Really Show? I'm making that announcement. It reminds me of my last flight from Denver to Salt Lake City. Just as they were closing the door, the flight attendant said, "This is flight 732 to Salt Lake City, and if that's not where you're going, now's a good time to complain." When I had the opportunity of fulfilling an LDS mission in the early 60s, 1960s, I was given the usual material as a missionary and was also given some things regarding the archaeology of the Book of Mormon, and I just happened to have kept those. I was given three flashcards and two handouts, and after reviewing them, I became an expert on Book of Mormon archaeology. I had a picture of Joseph Smith, and I told them that Joseph Smith was the Mormon prophet who obtained gold plates and translated the gold plates into reformed Egyptian language, and he produced the Book of Mormon. And I showed them some of the things that the Lamanites and Nephites have built in the New World. This happens to be from a place called Chichen Itza. And the Mormon Church was the only organization that really understood who the inhabitants were of the New World. I was also given two handouts, one of which indicated all of the archaeological information at that time and what it tended to show. And I recited these often as indications of the Book of Mormon being a historical account of the early inhabitants of the New World. And then I was even given a little map by someone who's well-respected down at BYU, and it showed... I'm serious about that. It showed the locations of Book of Mormon sites. We even have the narrow neck of land of Bountiful and land of Zarahemla, and any place else that you'd like to know where it was located, you can see me after. Well, in any case, in total good faith, I became an expert in Book of Mormon archaeology and acted accordingly. Well, lo and behold, after I returned and read a few articles, I came across an article written in some heretical journal called Dialogue by a Michael Coe, who is an archaeologist from Yale University. And he says, among other things, in his article published in 1973, "The bare facts of the matter are that nothing, absolutely nothing, has ever shown up in any New World excavation which would suggest to a dispassionate observer that the Book of Mormon, as claimed by Joseph Smith, is an historical document relating to the history of early migrants to our hemisphere." Well, I'm really confused now because I may be guilty of fraudulent teachings, but we have three experts today. They're going to help us sort out this seeming contradiction, and we're very grateful to have them with us today. I'd like to introduce all of them to you at this time, and then each one of them will have an opportunity to make an approximately 20-minute presentation, and we hope that after they're through, that we'll have some time for the questions from you. I'll introduce these gentlemen in the order in which they will appear. Our first guest is John Carlson. John obtained his Ph.D. degree in astronomy from the University of Maryland, and he is presently the director of the Center for Archaeoastronomy at the University of Maryland, and he is an affiliate assistant professor of astronomy and an adjunct assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Maryland. Our second participant will be Ray T. Matheny. Ray obtained his PhD degree in anthropology from the University of Oregon. He is a professor of anthropology at Brigham Young University and has done field work in cooperation with the New World Archaeological Foundation. And our final guest is Bruce Warren. Bruce received a PhD in anthropology from the University of Arizona. He also is a professor of anthropology at Brigham Young University and teaches a course at Brigham Young University in the Book of Mormon archaeology. So we'll hear from our guests in that order. We'll ask you to hold your questions until we've all had an opportunity to present their remarks. And for those of you who are a little concerned about the lateness of our start, we will be trying to allow full time and we'll be going into the lunch hour, so I won't interfere with other sessions you might be interested in. John?
Well, thank you. I think my first and greatest challenge will be to do this in 20 minutes, but this is always a problem for most of us speakers. I'll do my very best to stick to my time. I'd like to say a little bit about myself to begin with, since I'm from the University of Maryland, right outside of Washington, D.C., and since my training is as an astronomer, I was a radio astronomer, but since 1972, I became very interested in Native American cultures and the astronomical practices of Native American cultures. Part of this involved a trip to Mexico City for an international conference in 1973, and I made the fortunate mistake of going to the great National Anthropological Museum there, and my life started to change from that point. Got very interested in the cultures of Mesoamerica, and have done some research in the area of pre-Columbian Mesoamerican studies. So that is my area of expertise, and that's what I bring here today as part of my perspective. I would like to say that I am not a member of the LDS Church, and so my perspective is as someone who is out there amongst the archaeological or anthropological community with the perspective on Mesoamerican archaeology, which is probably relevant to the discussion of whether there is such a thing as Book of Mormon archaeology. Now, to start this off, I wanted to, besides saying something about my credentials, not very much, I wanted to show a few slides of things that I've been involved with, because I felt that probably very few of you had ever heard of me before, so I thought I would start that way. I'm not from BYU. So, again, I'm an astronomer. I am the director of the Center for Archaeoastronomy, and I edit a journal called Archaeoastronomy. You've probably never heard of that word either, because it's not in the dictionary. It's a new interdiscipline that's in the process of defining itself. And it is the study of ancient astronomical practices and celestial lore and worldviews and cosmologies of ancient peoples. All ancient peoples, not just the Western tradition, the Babylonian, Greco-Roman tradition, from which our modern scientific astronomy comes. We're interested in everything from Stonehenge to the alignment of Maya temples to the way in which the Polynesian navigators can go 3,000 miles across the Pacific without any kind of instrumentation and make landfall, the ultimate test of success in your astronomy. Last comment I want to make is that currently, and I believe that my colleagues would agree with me, that in American archaeology, there is somewhat of a schism between those people that you might call dirt archaeologists, the diggers. Many of them are cultural materialists and are interested in material questions, what people ate, you know, what kind of agricultural techniques. They'll deal with radiocarbon dates, pollen cores, this kind of material. On the other hand, there's another almost disparate group of people that are interested in ideologies. By that I mean art, iconography, hieroglyphic writing, religious systems, that type of thing. I tend to fall in that camp, although I have some perspective on the field. I think that this schism in archaeology is most unfortunate. You see it if you're an archaeologist, because the dirt archaeologists tend to go to one type of conference, and the ideology-oriented people tend to go to other conferences. But my perspective is as someone who has worked with hieroglyphic writing, art, iconography, and religious systems, as opposed to I am not a dirt archaeologist, and I have never dug at an archaeological site. Okay. Can I have the first slide, please? Slides are partly for entertainment and partly just to... Could we drop the lights just briefly, and I'll try to go through this as quickly as possible. Of my own, well, the... we checked this out. The only one that works is off. All the other numbers in this digital system here don't work. Okay, and if you want to ask any questions about this in the question period, this would be some areas I'd be able to answer. I did some work on the so-called Olmec concave iron ore mirrors. Now, the Olmec civilization goes back to perhaps 1200 to 1500 BC. We know that they made beautiful concave iron ore mirrors, like hematite, magnetite, and so forth. It's the earliest concave mirror tradition in the world that we know of. And so I have cataloged these and studied their properties and figured out how they were manufactured. So this is some of my own work. And I have some theories as to what they were used for. The two upper examples there are ones that I made using the same techniques that the Olmec lapidary must have used. This is one of the manufactured mirrors. In doing this, I became interested in an artifact that Michael Coe, the archaeologist at Yale, found in his excavations of the great Olmec site of San Lorenzo. This is on the Gulf Coast of Mexico. San Lorenzo, the San Lorenzo days from about 900 to 1200 BC, he found an artifact that was magnetic, made of a magnetic mineral. It looks like this. It could certainly have functioned as a compass. So I investigated the properties of this artifact and speculated on some of the questions of, could the object have been a fragment of an early compass? And if so, was it used in the orienting principles of sites in Mesoamerica? I'm not a believer in this, but it's a fascinating question. And I did what I thought I could with analyzing this and studying the structure of Olmec sites, such as this rather stylized reconstruction of La Venta. But there are certainly important orienting principles that we find in most Mesoamerican sites. They're carefully laid out according to plans we don't understand. I worked with Maya hieroglyphic writing. And this is what's called Altar Q at Copan, which was usually claimed to be a monument to an ancient astronomical convention. You'll see this repeated again and again. It is not. That's false. I did some work on this. It's an accession monument to a well-known ruler at Copan. This is perfectly well understood to just everyone that works in this field these days. I also have done work in the codices. This is one of my interests, are the ancient books of the Americas, of which approximately 17 examples of pre-conquest books have survived. And I've studied a certain god called God C, made some progress with this. God C seems to be an ancestral figure, a Maya ancestral figure. I've worked with what's called the Landa alphabet, which is one of the, it's the closest thing that one would want to call a Rosetta Stone to the Maya writing. There is no such thing as a Rosetta Stone for Maya writing. But the so-called Landa alphabet, produced in the mid-16th century by the third bishop of Yucatan, Diego de Landa, has been a key to the decipherment of Maya hieroglyphs. And you probably don't know this, but Maya hieroglyphs have yielded up much of their secrets in the last 10 to 15 years. I would say better than 80% of the inscriptions can now be read with considerable confidence. I've dealt with the double-headed Maya dragon motif as a celestial symbol. It's a long discussion of this sort of thing. That is what is pictured on the famous sarcophagus lid of Lord Pakal at Palenque. So should this, we have time, and should this become an interest as to what this means, we could certainly comment on this. But this is one of the most grossly misinterpreted things, everywhere from Eric von Däniken's astronaut, ancient astronaut, to various crosses, Christian crosses, and so forth. There's much that can be said about this, but some of the main images are the double-headed dragon draped over it. And finally, I've been working recently on the planet Venus. I gave a talk here last night at the Hansen Planetarium on Venus in the Maya world. It's one of my current areas of research. I'll just say that the planet Venus was essentially the Mars of the New World. Venus served as a god of war, and that hostile-looking spearing deity there, this is from Codex Borgia, is a page from one of five surviving Venus almanacs, and they appear to be the ritual almanacs for warfare. So So I think I'm qualified to make some new discussions of some of the new ideas about pre-Columbian warfare, particularly from the classic Maya to late central Mexico. So I can... this is an image you probably haven't seen, of Kakashka, one of the most hostile-looking Maya-type warriors you ever want to see. So my work has been with this fourth Maya book called The Grolier Codex. It was discovered recently, and I've been able to authenticate it and show that it's a very interesting Maya Venus almanac. That's it. Finally, you will never have seen this vase. It's a classic Maya vase showing a great battle scene. And the glyphic inscription contains the so-called star event, which contains the Venus glyph. To summarize, we now know that at least some of the ritual battles, like the one that is pictured on the famous Bonampak murals in the classic Maya realm in Chiapas, were timed for significant events in the Venus cycle, like the first appearance of Venus as morning star or the first appearance of Venus as evening star. So they literally waited until they could see Venus appear as evening star, and then they arranged for a battle where they would detain captives for later humiliation and sacrifice. And my final slide is, I'm currently working on a text of a book on Guatemalan archaeology for the University of Oklahoma Press. And what I'd like to do is have the lights on and give you a few perspectives on this question of the Book of Mormon archaeology. What does the evidence really show? I'm going to deal with this in four points. I thought one of the things that would be useful to do would be to make a list of the things that I thought that the three of us could agree on. Now, I might be wrong, so I put question marks next to a couple of them. But as I go through this, you might think about this. I'm going to guess that even though we have quite different backgrounds, we'll agree on this. First of all, let's assume that the Book of Mormon, as interpreted, I'll say the original Book of Mormon, as interpreted by Joseph Smith and interpreted by other people who have followed, let's assume that it is an historical account. I think that all of us would agree that the main part of the account deals with a time frame that's something around 600 BC to about 400 AD. I mean, roughly speaking, I think we'll agree that that's the time period that we're talking about, at least for the Nephites. Now, that corresponds to the late preclassic or formative period in Mesoamerica and the protoclassic and the early classic. Those are the archaeological names for the period in Mesoamerica. I think we agree on that. Spatially, I guess right from the beginning, there's been a great deal of debate about where geographically these regions would be, like Zara Hemlon and so forth. By the way, I hope, forgive me if I mispronounce things occasionally. I might simply not know. I think in general, I think I'm all right. But if I make a mistake, laugh, but I'll stand corrected. Spatially, we're probably talking about Mesoamerica. I don't think there's much chance that the region is being described, if indeed they are in the Western Hemisphere at all, would be anywhere other than somewhere in the Middle American region. So here's a point for question. However, the places referred to are not known in any way independently other than the Book of Mormon. We're studying the Bible. The Bible refers to Jericho. You can go find Jericho. It's a historical city. The Bible refers to Jerusalem. You can go find Jerusalem. Archaeologically, you don't even need the Bible to find many, many of these places that are described in the Near East. You know, they're archaeological, they're historical places. As far as I know, there aren't any of the places referred to in the Book of Mormon that are independently identified. Okay? We would all agree that not all American Indians are the Book of Mormon people. That is a gross misstatement. You can't say that all the American Indians are Lamanites or what have you. That even smacks of racism to suggest that. So I don't think any of us would agree that that's true. Okay? The Book of Mormon itself has not made a significant contribution to New World archaeology. Ask any New World archaeologist. Gordon Willett is one of the deans of American archaeology. his summaries of the state of the field, it certainly isn't mentioned. I'm not saying there should or shouldn't be, I'm saying as a fact, it has made no contribution to New World Archaeology. On the other hand, has New World Archaeology made any contribution to the authentication of the Book of Mormon as a historical account? I don't think so, but my colleagues might or might not agree. I don't think that New World Archaeology has done much of anything to help establish the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. That's something we need to discuss. Some of these are questions that were given to me in advance, perhaps to address and provide a perspective on. To the best of my knowledge, there is no non-LDS archaeologists who are influenced by the Book of Mormon or who use it in their work. I don't know of a single soul. Okay. And finally, these are all things I think we would agree on, by the way. Final thing I have here is that the various, I'm going to call them picture books. Now, I don't want to use the names of the authors. They might be in the audience. But I think you all know the books that we're talking about. These picture books are just so stories. And some of them have just been published, you know, 1984. They are a wealth of misinformation and a disservice. Okay? This is not good material. I will just tell you, in my reading of some of those older books that purport to deal with Book of Mormon archaeology, they are making errors on the level of someone saying, oh yeah, Salt Lake City, that's in Wyoming. Now, if you read a book that said that, Salt Lake City, Wyoming, you'd say, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And believe me, that is the level of scholarship. And I think that's one of the things that I think we'd all like to emphasize. If this is going to go well, and I think it can be done, you need solid scholarship. And that doesn't exist in many of these books. And so I don't think you should use them. I don't think you should read them. I think you should do it right. Okay, now a few more things that we could agree on. Some problems that we could agree on. I think we would all agree there are problems about metals and metal tablets from the late formative and early classic in Mesoamerica. If you wanted to have gold tablets from Chichen Itza, which is the early post-classic, all right, I'm willing to listen. But you show me some evidence for metal use in that period of time, I think it's a problem. The animals, the horses, the various cultigens, we've got a problem. We really have a problem here. The wheel. No number of little wheel play toys is going to solve this problem of where the wheel is. Linguistics is a huge problem. To my understanding, there is no such thing as Reformed Egyptian. You know, even if there were, I don't see that there's any evidence for it in Native American languages. Now, I'm not a linguist, but I know them. And that's one of your problems, is what to do with the linguistic question. And then finally, I mean, I think we all agree that these are problems. The general question about what about what the white man or Caucasian peoples in the Western Hemisphere prior to the Spanish conquest? And the general question of diffusion. What's the state of diffusionist studies these days? You know, where did St. Brendan sail his leather boats across the Atlantic? You know, were the Celts here? Were the Chinese here? Were people from the Near East here? These are tough questions. I don't have an easy answer to that. I am not a diffusionist myself, in the sense that I'm not committed to this, but it's one of the interesting kinds of questions that would have to be dealt with because that's the basis of the Book of Mormon, isn't it? Okay, so, all right. Now here's where I think I want to ask some tough questions. I'm past the list of agreements. These guys are really on the spot. Okay, the question is there such a thing as Book of Mormon archaeology, as opposed to archaeology or New World archaeology or what have you? If Book of Mormon archaeology, this is my question, and I'll address all of you and to think about and my colleagues. If Book of Mormon archaeology is a science, if it's a separate discipline, where's your data? Where is your data? Okay? Now, my understanding is that there is essentially, maybe absolutely, no Book of Mormon archaeological data. Okay, there is archaeological data that comes from archaeologists. But is there Book of Mormon archaeology data? Are there people who call themselves Book of Mormon archaeologists who have excavated sites and have data that we can all look at? Question. I don't think so. I don't believe that that's the case. There's plenty of archaeological data. There's more and more of it every day, and it's of pretty high quality. But as I understand it, the only source of data, in a certain sense, is the Book of Mormon itself. I mean, that is a source of this data. That's where the information is coming from. What is the Book of Mormon? Well, I'm going to give you my perspective. That's why I'm here, I guess. I think I'm being asked to consider that the Book of Mormon is, in some sense, an ancient American codex book, like the 17 other books that have survived. It may be different, but an ancient American book. Now, where is the book? Can I go study it? If I want to study the Maya Dresden Codex, I can go to the Library of Dresden in Germany and study a 12th or 13th century Maya manuscript. If I want to study Codex Borbonicus, which is an Aztec manuscript, I can go to the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris and study that manuscript. I have data. I'm a scientist. I have data. I can work with it. How about the Book of Mormon? I have Joseph Smith's translation, right? English language version of this. I can't look at those original tablets because they're not here. Now, as an archaeologist, I would love to do that. I can think of a lot of archaeologists that would love to do that. That would be data for Book of Mormon archaeology. Now, as a scientist, that disturbs me that I don't have access to that. I don't complain too loudly, but I wish that would be very useful, because indeed I've been working on this thing called the Grolier Codex, which was discovered in 1964, apparently in a dry cave in Chiapas. It's the only one of these ancient American books that has been discovered in modern times. All the rest were discovered in Europe, apparently haven't been taken there by the conquistadors or other people from the New World, and they surfaced in various libraries and private collections, if you follow what I'm saying. But this one was discovered recently. I'm quite certain that it's authentic now, and it's interesting. There may be other books that will be found. But at least I have the thing. I can study it either in the original, I can radiocarbon date it, or I can study the facsimile. So, and again, if I want to compare with some of the old world scholarly, recent finds, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, or the so-called Nag Hammadi Codices, which are Gnostic manuscripts, these have been recent finds that fit right in with our present knowledge about what archaeology and religion and so forth were like in the Near East from that time. You see what I mean? They fit. The Book of Mormon, as we have it, doesn't fit what us New World archaeologists normally deal with. It doesn't mean that it's wrong. I'm not going to make this mistake of absence of evidence is evidence of absence. Do you follow what I'm saying? I can't say that for sure. So it's always a possibility. But as things sit now, to be a science of Book of Mormon archaeology, we must have data. The only data I know about is the Book of Mormon itself. We do not have the original codex to study, unfortunately. So that's part of my question. So the task of Book of Mormon archaeologists will be to convince the community of scholars and demonstrate their results. And this is a question of scholarship. And I want to stress this. I'm an astronomer. I'm a member of something called the International Astronomical Union, which is the worldwide fellowship of astronomers. You go to meetings and you meet people from India, from Sri Lanka, from Indonesia, from everywhere else. We are all scientists. We all speak the same language. We all respect. There are differences of opinion, but we all know what data is, or at least we can discuss it and debate it. For Book of Mormon archaeologists to participate in scholarship, they must speak the same language and present their results in a scholarly fashion. By the way, I think there's some evidence that this is being done. I'm not saying it's all hopeless, but it's not in those picture books that I'm talking about. And science is international and it's independent of religion. So what you believe isn't important to me. It's the data. I'm not talking about religion and belief and faith, I'm talking about science. Now, I'll tell you, I know many people who are perfectly good Christians, who believe in the teachings of Jesus Christ and the doctrines of salvation and the whole thing. But they don't think the world was made in 6 days, and they don't necessarily think that the waters were parted for the Israelites to go through. I mean, there's a wide spectrum of opinion out there in the world on the nature of those stories in the Old Testament, for example. Everybody's entitled to their own beliefs. So if you're going to be an archaeologist working in Israel or Jordan or Syria, you follow certain rules. And so that's the challenge to Book of Mormon archaeologists. My final point, and I'm out of time, is one of my interests, professional interests, is in the nature of pre-Columbian American religion and current Native American religion. Okay? You can learn something about this. There's considerable evidence. And I don't see any relationship between the kind of religious, the nature of the religion as presented in the Book of Mormon, what I know about Native religion, like Aztec religion. I don't see any resemblance between those things. That disturbs me. In any case, the Book of Mormon must deal with a fairly small number of people and not all Americans. So I suppose it's still possible that all of this really happened somewhere in the New World in the late pre-classic and the early classic. Thank you.
Central Plateau of Mexico. And the reason for this is that writing has been found there. And the writing, indeed, is very ancient and goes back to D.C. times in some instances, although not much can be read from that period. And so peoples within the church and archaeologists have emphasized these cultural achievements. And many people have tried to make this judgment now that these areas where writing is found certainly testify to the Book of Mormon. Well, it'd be nice if that scene could be painted and accepted by scholars in general. As you can see by Dr. Carlson's remarks, certainly is not accepted. Let me paint for you a very brief introductory scene as to what the Book of Mormon presents for an investigator or a scholar like Dr. Carlson when they read the book. The book speaks of certain cultural achievements and cultural concepts about the earth and the universe that are most commonly associated with old world cultures. They also include a number of technologies, and these technologies are important for us to understand. Book of Mormon talks about ferrous and non-ferrous metallurgical industries. A ferrous industry is a whole system of doing something. It's just not an esoteric process that a few people are involved in. But ferrous industry, that means mining iron ores and processing these ores and casting these ores into irons and then making steels and so on. This is a process that's very complicated and involves many specialties of many peoples, and it also calls for cultural backup to allow such an activity to take place. In other words, society would have to be organized at a certain level before ferrous industry would be feasible. The technology of mining is problematical for the Book of Mormon. Where do you find iron ores in sufficient quantity to create an industry? I do not subscribe to the idea that iron was so esoteric as it is mentioned in the Book of Mormon. In my recent reading of the Book of Mormon, I find that iron and steel is mentioned in sufficient context to suggest that there was a ferrous industry here that's being alluded to. What evidence does the ferrous industry leave in the archaeological record? Well, those who have been associated in the industry know that not only is mining one of the evidences, that is, old mines have been located. We have found in North America copper mines and gold room. We found copper and gold and silver mines. We found iron mines. And the evidence is there. The tools that people used are primitive, but nonetheless they were there. They spell out the system of exploitation of those natural resources. And refining ores and then bringing these to casting and true metallurgical processes is another bit of technology that leaves a lot of evidence. You can't refine ore without leaving a bloom of some kind, or that is impurities that blossom out and float to the top of the ore that's being fused, and also the flux of limestone or whatever is used to flux the material also blooms off into silicas and indestructible new rock forms. In other words, when you have a ferrous metallurgical industry, you have these evidences. The detritus that's left over. You also have the fuels, you have the furnaces, you have whatever technologies that were there. Performing these tasks, they leave solid evidences, and they are indestructible things. The bloom is a new rock that has been formed by the process of making iron. Well, non-ferrous metallurgical industries have similar evidences. No evidence has been found in the New World for a ferrous metallurgical industry dating to pre-Columbian times. And so this is a king-size kind of problem, it seems to me, for so-called Book of Mormon archaeology. this evidence is absent. It's true that esoteric iron artifact has been found in pre-Columbian context. But these may be explained by meteoric iron, which does fall in some quantity. Eskimos are well known for their use of iron. A source of iron to the New World was found in Chinese and Japanese junks that drifted across the Pacific and was obtained by Northwest Coast Indians. Now, this is historically documented. But no metallurgical industry, we see these are just uses of iron occurring naturally. It's not listed. The non-ferrous metallurgical industries, they all take a high level of discipline, not disciplines, but technologies to make them work. One needs proper temperatures to melt these ores and also to work the metals. And to obtain temperatures beyond 1,000 degrees centigrade is very difficult. You need other devices. You need bellows, for example. Well, bellows have been mentioned in the Book of Mormon as one of the items. And one could accept that, perhaps. In the archaeological record, however, non-ferrous metallurgy does not appear in any great quantity in this Mesoamerican area where language is found until about the 12th or 13th century AD. There are a few evidences of metal before this time and non-ferrous, but it certainly doesn't amount to much of an industry, to say the least. There are no bronzes before the 13th century AD, and bronze, of course, is a mixture of tin copper. The bronzes come on the scene much later, closer to the time of the Spanish conquest, but antecedent to it. In South America, bronze industry comes on the scene much earlier. And the idea of bronze metallurgy was probably transferred from South America to the Mesoamerican area. Well, there are many references in the Book of Mormon to metal swords and cimeters and breastplates. In Jerem, on machinery, no less, whatever it could have meant there. Metal plates, engraving on metal plates, that is, metal chasing, using hardened steel-tipped tools to chase metal. Although some metal chasing is done by stamping, engraving is done by chasing the metal out with a very sharp tool. Gold and silver coinage is mentioned. Although there is no archaeological evidence for metal swords or machinery, no archaeological evidence for metal plates, there is no archaeological evidence for coinage in these areas of the New World. At least we have none dating from the period of time that we're concerned with. A few Roman coins have shown up here and there in archaeological context. But these esoterics really don't make the case, to say the least. There's a talk of using bow and arrow, spear points that may be associated with metal too. Shipbuilding, sailing, use of magnetic compass, overseas navigation, wheeled vehicles drawn by horses, tent manufacture, linen manufacture, many agricultural products from the Old World, vineyards and wine presses, domestic animals from the Old World, glass manufacture, and so forth. All these paint a scene that seemed to be quite foreign to what I am familiar with in the archaeological record of the New World. People have continually dragged up esoteric examples of many of these things. I don't know how to evaluate these. Sorensen has found a reference from Rene where sheep's wool has been found in archaeological context in Valley of Mexico. Also, metal-tipped, iron-tipped weapons used by the Aztecs when the Spaniards were invading was another. I really don't know how to understand these esoteric finds that are made. They're not in context that is understandable to them. We find esoteric things all over the world in archaeological context, but we don't understand what they mean. They're just oddities that appear. The things that we understand are things that fit into the system. As I was trying to explain something about a system of metallurgy, there are a whole bunch of technological ideas that have to be possessed and have to be understood and worked into the system before such a phenomenon can take place. An esoteric thing found in a society or in an archaeological context has little meaning to us. And so the archaeologist has neglected a lot of old things. Many Mormon scholars have tried to put these esoteric things together and thread together a story that would support the Book of Mormon. In general, the archaeologist does not do this. He does not weave together all these little esoteric pieces of things that would make one person's story stand up and another's not. There are some concepts that are bothersome to the investigators of the Book of Mormon. There's the concept of the world as an entire planet. There are cardinal directions in north, south, east, and west as we understand this. There's a mention in quotes, understanding the movement of the planets, which is a concept that perhaps Dr. Carlson could comment on. How could it be that people in the 34th century BC could understand the movement of planets? Well, maybe there's historic precedent for this in the old world. There's the use of a lunar calendar very clearly in the Book of Mormon. There's the use of the terminology of a shock, in the sense of an electrical shock, which is difficult to explain. There's a money economy with an agricultural backup. There's the idea of history that precedes the Greek historian Herodotus by a century. There's the idea of the mind, which we could talk about and seems a little bit out of place in the Book of Mormon. There are certain strategies of war. All these things paint a picture of very sophisticated societies, to say the least. And some of these items are certainly associated well known with old world cultures, but to have them in the new world is a real problem. Let's just look at agriculture in comparison to the metallurgy. We have plants brought from the old world, according to the Book of Mormon, of wheat, barley, corn, maize, maize, and shoe, whatever else it might be, flax, grape, olive. Maybe others. I just read up to about halfway in Alma and picked up these items. And no doubt beyond that there would be many others. But wheat. In archaeological context, there have been no wheat found that I'm aware of that date in pre-Columbian times. And there are many wheats, of course, that were domesticated in the old world. Barley. There are no old world barleys found in the new world that I'm aware of in pre-Columbian times. These were more recent historic imports. There has been a barley found in archaeological context in cultures reported in Science 83. And in talking with the archaeologists about this and the botanists who identified this fossil board, they assured me that this is a new world barley. This barley looks like it has been domesticated with proper signs where the rapids of the plant has folded away and released the kernel. It looks like a domestic effort here in a new world barley. But it has nothing to do with the old world barley. There's mention of corn. Corn is a new world plant. I mean, that's a real plus for the Book of Mormon when it says corn. Unless it means it in a different sense, I don't know. And then there is flax. Flax, mentioned numerous times in the Book of Mormon, not as flax. But it's woven linen and grapes and olives. But we don't find domestic grapes and olives in archaeological context. All of these amount to systems of doing things. There's a whole system of production of wheat and barley. There's a system of production of corn, which is well known in the New World as a specialized production of food. You have to know something to make flax grow, especially in tropical climates. Grapes and olives, all of these are cultures that are highly developed in the amount of these systems. And so the Book of Mormon is saying that these systems existed here
And there are animals from the world that which Master Singer takes. The ass and the dog, the cow, goat, wild goat, sheep, horse, ox, swine, elephant, girl, and cumin, and other names, calf and cattle. From one place I found corn and cattle, no less. Fowl, lamb, and fattening. These two are specializations. You just don't have a cow or a goat or a horse as an esoteric pet or something. There's a system of breeding these things. And the picture that was painted for me as I read this, and for others too, is that we have old world technologies, metallurgy, many ideas and concepts, agriculture, domestic animals, and so forth, in the new world. Now, some of the Aldea scholars have tried to explain away the agricultural products and the animals. They said, well, the Spaniards didn't know what to call a peccary in the new world. They didn't know what name to give to a tapir called a cow, and what have you. But as I read the Book of Mormon, these names of animals and plants, I'm just going to throw them out as some substitution for lack of understanding and explanation of what's being said. But there is a literary context for the use of the word horse. Ammon, in Alma there, you know, about 13th chapter or something like that, he's in the stable there preparing the horses for King Lamona. And also, he's preparing the king's chariots because he's going to take the trip from one city to another over the Royal Highway. And also, the horses are pastured, no less. So there are contexts within the Book of Mormon itself, literary contexts for these animals. These are not just substitutions, it seems to me, but the authors of the Book of Mormon are providing the context. They're not trying to describe a tapir or something else, it seems to me. This is a weak way to try to explain the presence of these names in the Book of Mormon. Well, I have been impressed with the way some of this comes off in my last reading of the Book of Mormon. I am particularly impressed with the first seven chapters of the Book of Mormon. I think that there's an overall context for the Book of Mormon. It certainly stated there in the best terms that I can find. I really have difficulty in finding issue or quarrel with those opening chapters of the Book of Mormon. But thereafter, it doesn't seem like a translation. It seems more like a transliteration. And the terminologies and the language used and the methods of explaining and putting things down are 19th century literary concepts and cultural experiences. One would expect that Joseph Smith and his colleagues would experience. And for that reason, I call it a transliteration, and I'd rather not call it a translation after the seventh chapter. And I have real difficulty in trying to relate these cultural concepts, as I briefly discussed here, with archaeological findings that I'm aware of. And I try to keep up on most of the developments that take place in the new archaeology. If I were doing this cold like John Carlson is here, I would say in a bad way to perform it. And had no place in the new world whatsoever. And we'd have to look for the place of the Book of Mormon events to have taken place in the old world. It just doesn't seem to fit anything that he has been taught in his discipline, nor I in my discipline. And anthropology and history, there seems to be no place for it. It seems misplaced. It seems like these are anachronisms. It seems like the items are out of time and place. Trying to put them in the new world. And I think there's a great difficulty for the Mormons in understanding what this book is all about. We're all involved in this in one way or another, it seems. That's why we're here to discuss it. And this forum provides an opportunity for discussion that's quite different from the church experience. We're there with an attempt to reinforce faith all the time, but we cannot bring up these questions. Now, in my work as an archaeologist, what might I say that comes from a discipline that might be positive for the good one? Well, really, very little. Something that seems more significant to me personally than many of the writers. And that is, recently, we have made a case, and I don't say myself that made a case, but National American Scholars have made a case that high level civilization existed in the New World, and particularly in Mesoamerica, in the Maya, lowlands, highlands, and in the highlands of central Plateau of Mexico, at a very early time. And in fact, discoveries in the Maya lowlands in recent years has pushed back the advent of civilization and the development of very sophisticated culture into the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries B.C., which is quite remarkable. If you pick up any book on the archaeology of Mesoamerica right now, it will not make that statement. It will say that civilization came on the scene not any earlier than the 3rd century A.D., and that true civilization on state-level political organization did not occur until the 7th and 8th centuries A.D., and then it lasted about 150 years of collapse. But recent discoveries of places like El Mirador, where I've been working, are astounding scholars. And I have scholars calling me up, like Michael Cove, for example, and say, Ray, does that really exist out there at El Mirador? Were those buildings really as big as you say they are? And I have to respond, yes. And are they as old as you say they are? And I have to respond, yes. We've got 100 test excavations out there. We've had scholars from many institutions. And we've had independent studies, radiocarbon dates, and so forth, across dating of artifacts. And yes, we can say that a very high level of civilization existed at least from the 2nd century B.C. in the Maya lowlands that is almost unparalleled elsewhere for that time period. When you talk about buildings that are 18 to 20 stories high and have bases that are 500 feet that would sit over a city block, no less, and acropolises that are 1,000 feet and 1,100 feet long, and huge plazas that are half a kilometer in length, and have 16 square kilometers of public buildings and causeways and reservoirs and so forth, you're talking about a high level of civilization. And what's more, we have found what some scholars think to be writing, some of the earliest writing found. Now, what my approach to all this is to lay a science base. I have felt that Mormons, on the point of written text, have got many differences. But that's not necessarily so. I think no evidence is no evidence. All you have to do is examine cases where there has been no evidence on the historical problem, and it's been assumed then that this is negative, and later on, evidence has turned up, and that turned out to be a positive. We should have left at the point that more evidence is no evidence. I think also with a situation such a incipient position and trying to define such a discipline as Book of Mormon archaeology, that we have to deal with the positive, critical approach to this problem. That is, you assume that there's nothing to the record in a historical sense, there's nothing to do. There's no questions to ask, there's no research to be planned and carried out in a scientific manner or otherwise. I think the only approach that you can really bring this one to the answer to the long run is a positive approach that says, let's assume that it is true. And if it is true, then what are the expectations? What are the requirements that has to be found in order to substantiate what the record claims? It's what's called a conditional statement in logic, an if-then type of statement. And the if part has to come from the words in the text of the requirement. The then part comes from the test form.
through scientific means. In other words, what can we do now, then, I think, is try to work up several, if necessary, hypothetical models that really count for what we're being told is what harm. And of course, this means that almost immediately you have to come to grasp with the size of lands that have been talked about in that account. And what we have to deal with are simply travel in terms of days of travel. There's no distances given as miles, kilometers, or any other measure. It's how many days people travel just from one place to another. And this is what lays the way that some of the ancient chronicle texts from North America deal with distances, this amount of days traveled. For example, in Ishmael's Machigo's writings, he's a lady prince from Valley, Mexico in the late 16th century. He gives an account of a migration that involves some 14 stops. And he tells us that they traveled 5-6 legumes per day, and that this was the custom. They traveled from dawn to sundown. And in other words, he gives a clue that those people traveled maybe 12 to 15 miles per day to travel. But we take this as kind of a yardstick and apply it in a few cases in the book form to give you some idea that we're really dealing with a very small area. For example, just give you one example from the book form. We're told that I traveled from the land of deep market to the southernmost land to a land of Zarahemla, which was from north and down, involved for many, many children every year and so forth, 21 days of travel. What does that mean? That's probably 250 to 300 miles. It's a very short area. And so we have to be looking at a particular place in the new world that we're going to develop this discipline. There's enough evidence in there that we're dealing with a high level of society, a very complex type of society in the town. And when you consider that, and there's only two areas you can really look at. One is the Andean region of South America, and the other is the Mesoamerican region, central southern Mexico and the northern part of Central America. You have to make a choice between one and the other, but you also can't deal with both. If you're even going to find a discipline dealing with the Book of Mormon. Without mentioning the details, you eliminate, I think, the Andean region quite readily. First, development toward complex civilization there seemed to come out of the roots of a maritime type of civilization, which is not strongly dependent upon any kind of a farming or horticultural base. That's contrary to what the Book of Mormon requires for the first colony of Jeremiah. And then the geography is supposed to go from a west sea to an east sea. The Andean civilization area does not go from the Pacific over to the Atlantic. It doesn't work that way. So I think that the only place we really try to work this problem out is in North America. Now, it's obvious that if the count is correct, they did not come into an empty land. There were people already there. And this is the thing that's going to complicate the language situation. It's going to complicate what you're going to look for specific kinds of customs and so forth. And how will it complicate it? The record is clear that toward the end, both of these civilizations that the Book of Mormon talks about were destroyed. Who survived? It was the Indians. And the question we're going to be looking at mainly in most of our discoveries in archaeology are going to be the monuments, the ruins of the people that were opposed to the particular tradition that we talked about in the Book of Mormon in terms of their religious beliefs. Now, are we at a point where we begin to define that place? And I think that we probably are. We haven't got one model that's going to be the salvation of this whole problem, but I think that there are two models that are seriously being considered. And one of them places the riverside, which is the only river mentioned in the book, comment that would be in the that it's a historical record, but that's the one that's mentioned. And because of the particular requirements of the internal reconstruction geography, one of the two models says that this would be the Shinsinko River, or the other model says that it would be the Grimaldo River, you know, the two candidates. And I think this began to focus the same in an area where they start looking for the kind of evidence we need. Now, I think I'd like to stress is that if you're going to find the kinds of evidence that is required from the words to attest to it one, somebody's going to be setting up the strategy, setting up the problem, setting up the models, and getting the funds to get out there and try to find that kind of evidence. You usually don't find evidence for a certain thing like you're looking for. And archaeology has many examples of this, where something has been discovered and happenstance becomes part of the thing and then it's dropped. And but people are looking for these sorts of things to that point. Now, one or two things I can address here in possible beginnings. These are only indications or clues, and you certainly don't define any with more archaeology. But one of the questions we have here, Paul says, as many book of Mormon geographic locations have identified in the New World, I suppose the answer is most obvious there would be only one was place where we covered in New York State. But I think that there are two or three interesting possibilities here turning out. And I'll mention it. One is there was a geographical location mentioned in the Book of Mormon, the book of Ether in particular, called the Hill Shim, S-H-I-M. It's a strange name and so on, but there is an interesting possibility there. The Maya word for car in the Shim spelled the same way. In the southern Veracruz, there is a hill. That's not in either name, it's an Aztec that means same happy, it means calling him. This is essentially the meaning, apparently, of the Hill Shim. Does that mean that same happy is Hill Shim? It's just an indication, somebody's got to find out. And what you find out is you have to go over time to get kind of evidence to help confirm that sort of thing. So it's only an indicator, it's not a proof. And another possibility is one of the place names in the book is called the town of Sidon and Mount Hemingway. The Maya in the 16th century called the archaeological ruins of Jacques Carzo Sapun or Sapun, which means white wine or white storm. The familiar meaning of the name Sidon is wine or limestone. Possibility today. Is it the proof? No, it's not a proof. One of the kind of indicators that may help if you're going to try to put together a discipline or put them on the part of the element. One of the big problems here in trying to help this discipline is that there's no institutional support for this among Mormons. Now, this may be a surprise to you. Some of you may think that the New World Archaeological Foundation was set up to investigate the Mormon archaeology, and it was by an individual church member. When he ran out of initial funding, this organization was put in the direction of BYU. At that point, it was the strategy for the Mormon research. It was just a conventional Mesoamerican research organization since 1961. And I've heard some people say, well, the Mormon Church is down investigating the Book of Mormon to the New World Archaeological Foundation. We haven't said anything for the last 25 years. We haven't found anything. So, since 1961, there's been no strategy to do such a thing. So, and they've got instructions not to say anything about the Book of Mormon anymore, if they have interesting. But another interesting possibility, I think, is coming up, and when we talk about with Mormon archaeology, I think we've got to stress the interpretation of archaeology. That means we've got to go beyond the ruins and the artifacts to languages, to chronicles, to painted codices, to any sort of information that could be used that may be helpful to Just one example of an exciting possibility, I think, is a recent article dealing with the Philadelphia on the Mission Tech Post. Current among the two that was sent by Cortez in 1519 to Europe. For many, many years, scholars considered this simply a ritual text. Many, many, probably 400 dates of it in the calendar system, from the calendar system of North America. But they assumed that these had no historical content, and therefore they did not measure the flow of time. But Gordon Brotherson, in the last 2 years, has published a manuscript he calls Key to the Chronology of the Codice, in which he thinks he's found the place date in which he put at Vienna and some other codices are calculated from. And he's right, but then there's a good deal of historical information there. As a matter of fact, the earliest date would be 3109 BC, and there'd be 110 days between 3109 BC and 590 BC. Three-fourths of those days associated with the Pokemon by placement. And parts of Oaxaca, some Puebla, and parts of the coast of Veracruz. Now, here's a very exciting prospect. Try to find out what the Pokemon mean, where they're located, and do some archaeology. To somebody who does that, but what can you say is going to come out of that sort of thing? I make a number of very interesting possibilities, but you don't have time to do that. Now, some things that I think is in the long run will become some of the best evidence, and some really good evidence on the book form, are going to come from a surprising source. It's not going to come directly from some things that are said in the book. It's going to come, I think, from a source like secret societies or secret combinations that they keep talking about, that have brought down their downfall, their destruction. And I suspect that when we find more about this from Mesoamerica, that we do know that the deities that we erode, that there's a deity of secret societies, and compare this with the old world, and I think you might find some interesting things on planetary deities, associated with constellations and so forth, that'd be rather interesting. I put together one chart that compares Egypt, Greece, Mesopotamia, India, and North America. And we come up with some very interesting things in terms of the calendar, the days of the week, five visible planets, and then some moons on it, like seven, and then a couple of ships, positions, and so forth. And I think that's certainly very exciting. And that's the kind of thing I think that may include most people, and probably ensuring possible near Eastern and North American people to be in the record for the But I suspect that we'll find it in the secret societies for some of these calendars, such as the 20th day of the calendar, and the deity behind the population of the country. And so you won't find that unless you directly mention it in the text of your book, or more or less opposed to it. I suppose you have to say in kind of summary that today there really is no book on archaeology. But I think that we're in a position that we know where it's about to be. And I think that in 25 years that this is going to be a challenging situation.
We're going to take this a little bit more time because of our late start. I want to just ask Dr. Carlson the first question, and then I'll ask any of you who have questions to answer those. And if you have them for a specific speaker, please address it to them, and we'll have them come to the podium. Dr. Carlson, Dr. Warren and other Mormon writers have raised the supposition that perhaps the Book of Mormon culture was smaller than we thought, and that even though there's no Book of Mormon archaeology now, that there's a possibility that that culture will be discovered, and obviously that's always a possibility. What, in your opinion, is the likelihood of that happening?
Well, I would describe myself as a, in general, as a practicing skeptic about almost everything. I enjoy that way of living. I enjoy the questions almost more than the answers. And as an astronomer, I know that there's so much about the universe that we're never going to understand, certainly not in my lifetime. I think that as I see the evidence right now, and I think probably any Mesoamerican archaeologist that you would put up there and ask that question, I think the chances of evidence for the Book of Mormon civilizations being found are very, very small, very vanishingly small. And I suppose it does depend on numbers of people. A lot of this relates to the general question of long-range diffusion. If you want to say that three people from the Near East made it to the New World in a boat and brought along a horse and some wool and an iron tool or something, I have no quarrel with that. That could have been true. But the question is, is there any evidence that it influenced Native American culture? This is always the question with diffusion and diffusionists. Is they want you to, they believe, it's a matter of the heart for them. They want to believe that people were going back and forth across the Atlantic and Pacific. I have no quarrel with that, but did they have a cultural impact? Now, I don't think you can get away with less than tens of thousands of peoples being involved with the Book of Mormon civilization. I think that they're explicit enough. You just can't talk about a few people. And as Professor Matheny just said, iron technology, barley technology, all these things, you would find evidences of it. I think you know how some of this is done. They take cores down into ancient lakes and they do palynology, for example. They look for the pollen grains that have come from various cultigens. They can watch in Mesoamerica, for example, when corn agriculture came up and went down when there were problems with climate change and things. Not very accurately, but at least you can see what was growing there. This was not growing there. That's a real problem. I would say that I don't think there's any chance at all that this can be archaeologically established. Vanishingly small. But I would be open to it if you could show me, because I'm open to almost anything. I'm serious. I'm completely serious. I don't mean that as a humorous statement. It would fit my worldview fine to say that there are advanced life forms out there in our galaxy, and maybe they've been here in the past, and maybe they in the last. The Earth is 4.6 billion years old. Maybe they've been here and in some way influenced the course of evolution of life on this planet. You can demonstrate this fine. It's not going to upset my worldview at all. In fact, almost nothing will, I think. My question. I don't think so.
Okay, over here. Three speakers have been well established that there's no archaeology for the Book of Mormon. Dr. Matheny and Dr. Warren indicated that the possibility of the area being in Mesoamerica and Mandela in the Andes, going to the Andes. But there is a third possibility that a lot of people are not considering, even though many of them have been aware of it now for at least 2 years. And there is definitely a geography of the Book of Mormon that's found within 300 miles of Palmyra, a radius of some 300 miles of Palmyra. A study was made, starting some 5 years ago, culminated in a publication last year, in which the individual secured maps of the areas around Palmyra, New York, Pennsylvania, Canada, and Ohio. This individual has identified at least 50 names of places with names that come out of the Book of Mormon. Camp Palmyra, or Zarahemla, Jerusalem, Mountable, Ramah, many others. They're all within that area that Dr. Warren mentioned, people that would have traveled in some 21 days. And this study has taken some of these geographic maps like you showed, you had on your mission, and some others have been done by the people of BYU, showing the relative position of towns, rivers, hills. And these have been superimposed upon this area back there. seen or paid attention to the copy of the study.
Yeah, I read it.
And Dr. Sorensen responded to the study by sending a copy of one of his recent papers. Dr. Anderson, BYU, his response was, this is mind-boggling. Can you comment on this?
Dr. McKinney, yes,
it is.
I'd like to say this study is very intriguing and Mormons ought to take it seriously. And it's a real challenge. And people ought to look at that and look at it from a historical perspective. Find out whether those names on the maps that are presented were prehistorically derived or were they historically conjured or what. There's a real question here with this document. And I have great respect for people who did this.
Who did it?
Give us the name. Virgil Pauli. It's for sale in the book.
There are several other things we ought to take seriously, too. We ought to look at James A. Dare's 1775 publication, which was available at the time, well, before just this day, of course. And there's a thesis about the Jews in America and identification with American Indians. There's also Lord Edward Kingsborough's publication, several volumes. The first volume came out in 1831, the same thesis. Even though it was published after the Book of Mormon was published, nonetheless, the references and ideas that formulated the 1831 publication were available to Joseph Smith and his colleagues. Now, there's a challenge. And Mormons need to pick up, investigate that. In fact, Mormons would be remiss if they didn't investigate every one of these things. I mean, if you're going to understand your religion and what the Book of Mormon is, you must accept every challenge. And there's a good one. That one of Pauli's is a good challenge. And I've asked some of my colleagues, well, how do you handle this? Don't have time for it. Well, we're all busy in doing our things, you know, but somebody better take some time with it. That's my view of all these challenges.
I've noted in the few years that I've been kind of hobnobbing casually with NWAF personnel and former NWAF personnel, they fall into two camps. Some who went into archaeology hoping that they could contribute to improving the Book of Mormon. Others who went into archaeology who just have a lot of discipline and are still in it. And from talking to some of these people who have since become disaffected, if you will, with the NWAF, because it has continued to be a conventional tool of archaeology rather than an extension of the missionary department, some of these people are highly critical of Gareth Law and his methods in Chiapas. And anyone that knows much about archaeology will know that Chiapas is basically a monopoly of Gareth Law and his people. There's not been a great deal of serious work done by organization other than the NWAF in that region. Now, if you take John Sorensen's thesis, which for anyone that's interested will be soon published, and it's the first time we have a model which may have some credibility to it by a person who has enough experience that would probably have to take a look at what he's saying. He said the most important one thing was in Chiapas. Now, I'd like to have Ray speak to. Is NWAF sloppy in some of their methods? Have they never taken soil samples? Is it true that they never found any phyllites because they never looked for any phyllites? If we were to go back to 1961 and ask a lot of different questions, is it possible that some of the things that are now in the NWAF monograph series could have been different as a result of having people looking for different things along the way?
Okay, who responded there? Dr. Carlson would also like to respond to some of that. We can be critical of anybody's work. In fact, that's the very nature of science, is to criticize someone's work. Otherwise, there's no point doing it in the first place. And then to be big enough to accept the criticism on the other end of it. And to improve your methods or do something different or look further or expand your program or what have you. The foundation, the New World Archaeological Foundation, in my opinion, has done a marvelous job. Not without criticism, however. I could give you a long list of criticisms.
and some of them will be acceptable science criticisms, and maybe their approach to certain problems doesn't meet my standard. But that just kind of falls by the way. Those people who have been working in the foundation for the last 30 years have literally sacrificed their lives for that job. It's not something that maybe you would want to do. There are very few people that would be willing to do what they have done. It has altered their lifestyles. It has altered their worldviews, their natures. They have become Mexicans. And not that that's derogatory, but they have changed. They are different people than us. Because they have simply given up their life in the United States and gone there and have literally sacrificed it for professional work. There's a lot of sloppiness, and a lot of mistakes, and a lot of mismanagement, and all kinds of things that could be brought up as problems involving the personnel and the way things have gone on. But when you look at 50 publications that are on the library shelves around the world, and it will be around a lot longer than any of us, then they have made a contribution. And they have stuck to their guns. They have stuck to an inhospitable place, in my opinion. And they have created a science base for that area. And I give them a lot of credit. Now, they have not taken a lot of soil samples, but they have taken some soil samples. And have paleontological studies. I have not had any phytolithic studies, because phytolithic studies are still in their infancy. Phytoliths are not easily discerned. And it's a new area of archaeology. This area of investigation, you can ask paleontologists to study phytoliths for you. And so, well, we didn't have to bone up on that. But it means that you don't have experience in it. And in fact, I'm in this process right now. The professor and I are devising some ideas about phytolithic investigations. And we find that the corn and the grasses will yield the greatest data with phytoliths. And this will give us some limited information. But we need to be overburdened with that one approach, you see. So I don't have damning criticism against the foundation. I have praise for what they've done. On the other hand, there's room for improvement, reorganization, perhaps. Some people are pushing for this. And as far as an organization going out and doing, in quotes, bookworm archaeology, I think this is a serious procedural error. In other words, you start out, you need the answer before you go out and do your work. And you cannot expect to come up with acceptable results if you have answers before you go out. My whole approach to this work is to do science work. That's all. Science has provided us the methodology, many of the tools, and objectives. We have a series of questions to answer before one can get into such specific things as performing problems.
I just wanted to react to that too, because, you know, fortunately, I'm not in any kind of political position regarding the church, regarding the BYU, or the World Foundation, or anything. What I can tell you is how it's viewed by the community of scholars. In a certain sense, that's what we're judging science by, is the world scientific community. The work of the New World Archaeological Foundation is very highly respected. The best things going in New World archaeology, period. And I mean, you could ask a Japanese archaeologist or anyone else who's familiar with the work, and they would agree. And this doesn't mean that they don't have some shortcomings like everybody else, but it is uniformly of the highest quality work. And this is generally accepted. I don't know if that's answering the kind of question that you. What do you want? Do you want an organization that will simply try to reinforce faith, or do you want good science, good archaeology? What are you doing with that?
We're just out of time. I'm sorry, I know there's a lot of other questions. I'd like again to thank our three participants for their presentation. Thank you all.